For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to our Sunday edition of Atlanta's Morning News. I'm Scott Slade, here each weekday morning with the information you need to start your workdays. And on Sunday, we put aside this special hour to go in-depth on issues and stories important to Metro Atlanta. This past week, WSB Health reporter Sabrina Cupid scores a remarkable one-on-one interview with CDC Director Rochelle Walensky as she moves to reorganize the agency in light of lapses in their response to the COVID pandemic.
For 75 years, CDC and public health have been preparing for COVID-19, and in our big moment, our performance did not reliably meet expectations.
Sabrina, this was just a remarkable, candid conversation you had with the director of the CDC. Were you surprised by how candid she was?
I was a little surprised because there had been limited information from the CDC from the very beginning. And she, you know, she talks and has news briefings from time to time, but getting a one-on-one with her hadn't been as easy as it had been with, you know, Frieden or others in the past. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean, she was very open, very honest, transparent. I felt like she was really trying to do the right thing and rebuild trust within the agency.
Well, thanks for doing this. It's a remarkable conversation.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let's listen.
Dr. Walensky, you're calling for a reorganization at the Atlanta-based agency after its botched handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, saying that it fell short responding to the pandemic and needs to become more nimble. You said that the agency had been preparing for something like this for, what, 75 years? I guess the first question is, so what happened?
You know, I think that the agency and its incredible people and its incredible subject matter expertise within the agency have not been prepared for the given moment, for the moment that we needed to be nimble, that we needed to be flexible. We have the capacity for incredible scientific academic rigor. We've been talking to our scientific public health experts. And importantly, now we needed to talk to the American people. We needed to put out guidance that was fast, that provided data to the American people. And we did not have the capacity. We were not groomed for that moment.
And I have to say, I was one of the reporters when this all began, the pandemic, and they were saying, masks don't do anything, no need to go out and get them. The next thing we know, oh, masks are needed. It was very confusing. There were a lot of different messages being sent out. It was a lot of, and I hate to talk politics because I'm not a political person per se, but did politics play a big part in this? What part did it play?
So maybe I'll unpack that a little bit. I certainly wasn't at the agency at the very beginning, but I will say that there are several things that have been moving at the same time. First of all, the science has evolved. We needed to recognize this was a new pathogen, what we were learning about it, what we were finding in the literature, what we were finding in the data. Every day we were learning something new. And so we as CDC have the responsibility in public health to update our guidance, update our actions based on the new science that we find. And one of the things that I'm really calling for as part of this review is to provide those data faster to our public health partners and to the American people, to be very public about those data, and then to update our guidance in real time as we learn more and more.
Right. And the agency is based here in Atlanta. This reorganization, is it going to mean that some people will be losing their jobs? And if so, how many do you think?
Thank you for asking that question, because the answer is definitively no. We have incredible people within this agency. And this is an agency, quite honestly, we read the headlines too. We're working very hard to support public health, and we want to be better. We want to serve the moment that is required and expected of us. We have, I would say there's going to be some reorganization, but that's not going to be a large part of the activities that we're engaging in to improve. And as part of that reorganization, one of the things I've told my leadership already is that everybody here is a valued member, and that we really anticipate that we will find incredible areas for their expertise.
Do you think the missteps within the agency prolonged the pandemic at all?
I think that's very hard to say. I think that there's been many factors that have been challenging within this pandemic. certainly the moment was now for us to take a mirror and look and see what we could have done better. But I also think that there have been real challenges across many different aspects of addressing this pandemic.
You head the agency, so some might say the buck stops with you. So do you feel like you let the public down in any way, or what would you have done different, and how do you feel about this?
You know, there certainly I inherited this incredible place about halfway through this pandemic. There were some real challenges when I got here, and I have to own those. And there have been challenges since I arrived, and I have to own those as well. And among the things that we did is really a full overview of not only things that we did during the pandemic, but some of the challenges that we had even before the pandemic. And that is reflected in this review, how we communicate our science to the American people, how we communicate our guidance, how we have to be nimble and provide our scientific findings and our data faster, and really how we have to have a rapidly actionable, deployable workforce so that when there is a challenge like a pandemic, we are ready to move.
And right now, we not only have COVID-19 out there, we have monkeypox, we have polio, we have flu season coming up. Is the CDC ready and equipped to handle all of these and then any other new threats that might arise?
So I think that one of the things that's important to recognize is we don't know what threat will arise tomorrow. We certainly have our share of threats that we're handling right now, but we have incredible subject matter expertise in each of these areas. And I think the important thing and one of the things that we're going to be doing during this reorganization is elevating the core public health capabilities that we thrive on at CDC, our workforce, our data systems, our laboratory systems, because if we're strong in our core public health infrastructure, then we will be prepared to tackle anything that comes our way.
WSB Health reporter Sabrina Cupid speaking with Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky this past week. This is Atlanta's Morning News Sunday Edition. I'm Scott Slade. Well, this came up toward the end of the week. The collective peril we're all in, just getting from point A to point B. A new federal report shows deadly car crashes are hitting 20-year highs. 460 dying on Georgia highways in the first 3 months of the year. Georgia fatal crashes are up nearly 10%. WSB's Michelle Wright helped us cover this.
In fact, maybe you even sat in one of our red alerts that we had this morning.
We're still shut down here in East Atlanta. I-20 westbound rollover crash.
The number of deadly crashes is up around the country. Here in Georgia, it's 9.5% higher for the first quarter of this year over last year. The increase in wrecks nationally is due to a higher number of impaired drivers. The jump in crashes is also leading to an increase in insurance costs since companies are having to pay out for more people and on more expensive vehicles once they're totaled.
We got a couple of minutes with WSB consumer expert Clark Howard on this.
Insurers are always the bad guys, but in this case, the auto insurers in particular have been crushed by the cost of repairing vehicles and the cost of replacing one after it's totaled. The vehicles are showing so much value right now in the used car market that when one's totaled, the amount the insurer has to pay is way up. Plus, truth is, we don't drive as well as we used to. I mean, post-COVID, everybody thinks this is the demolition derby we're in. So you can ask anybody. They'll tell you people are driving worse now than they were pre-COVID. So we brought this on ourselves in part with how we're driving. And then the marketplace, due to inflation in these various categories, has put a world of hurt on the auto insurers. It's hard to feel bad for auto insurers, though. And so these increases that the insurers are seeking, and it's not just Allstate, are because many of the auto insurers are actually losing money right now. Can you believe it? I mean, people are going to be mad I'm defending the auto insurers. So even though if you're an Allstate insured, and they may be bumping up your rates a whole lot, insurers decide different risk profiles on different drivers and charge different premiums on different drivers. So shopping around at a time when rates are rising is even more important than it would be regularly.
Infrastructure attracts people to a community. I mean, it's just more than roads and power lines. It's the quality of schools and the quality of life. And is anything more important than your safety? DeKalb County's top executive calls it a milestone day in announcing pay raises for its police officers, firefighters, paramedics, and EMTs.
6.5% for all starting salaries. We can't just talk the talk. Sometimes you have to walk the walk.
CEO Michael Thurman tells me starting salaries would now be among, if not the highest, in the state of Georgia.
It's a step in the right direction. However, it's a long way from the mark that we need to be at.
Retired officer Jeff Wiggs now heads the county fraternal order of police. He says a 20% raise would be optimal to keeping or attracting officer talent. Thurman says the raise is not enough, but
that's why we're going to continue to invest going forward.
Edgar Tragetts, 95.5 WSB.
These increases will put DeKalb first responders among the highest paid in the state. Let's dig deeper with Edgar Tragetts' conversation with DeKalb CEO Mike Thurman. And Thurman, answering criticism that these raises aren't enough?
Well, it's not enough. That's why we're going to continue to invest going forward. This is the result of a five-year strategy. Just this year alone, it's been more than a 12.5% increase. We're going to continue to invest. We are proud of where we are today, but myself or no one else in the governing authority believes that we can stop now. We have to continue to make investments going forward, and I have every belief and faith that that's exactly what we'll do. Because the other counties, you know, Edgar, I can almost guarantee you that other counties will now increase their salaries. So it's an ongoing process. It never ends, but I am proud of where we are today in this market.
Coming up next, we'll follow up on a story you heard this past week, success in fighting human trafficking in Georgia. We'll talk to some of the agents involved in what can be very emotional and rewarding work. Stay with us. This is Atlanta's Morning News Sunday Edition. I'm Scott Slade. Following up on the FBI's latest report on Operation Cross Country, they've rescued dozens of kids from sex trafficking operations nationwide, including here in Metro Atlanta. WSB's Veronica Waters speaks to some of the agents involved and how they speak of their essential, rewarding, and sometimes emotional work.
In a way, FBI Special Agent Taylor Dervish is defying the odds.
They do say the life of a Crimes Against Children investigator is usually about 3 years, so I guess in a sense, I'm geriatric in this field.
That's because all eight of Dervish's years in the Bureau have been spent in the division probing some of the most unthinkable crimes: child abductions, sextortion, child pornography, and sexual trafficking of children.
To be honest with you, not much surprises me anymore, but it always sticks with me how smart and capable a lot of these victims are, and they've just been dealt a bad hand. They come from families who don't support them, don't provide for them in the way that children should be provided for. And unfortunately, they feel that their only options are to turn to this kind of life.
Disrupting the criminal networks that ensnare kids and adults, too, in that dark kind of life is the focus of Operation Cross Country 12, meshing the forces and resources of the FBI with state and local partners into a massive nationwide dragnet. After 2 weeks in early August, the 56 field offices ID'd and found 84 victims of child sex crimes and rescued 37 missing kids. The youngest victim is 11 years old.
We do know that there are common risk factors for these kids, and one of the big ones is adverse childhood experiences. So sexual abuse at home, history of mental illness within the family, and ultimately being placed into foster care. And I think, unfortunately, that's happening to younger and younger kids nowadays.
141 more rescued trafficking victims are adults. 85 suspects have been ID'd or arrested. On the ground in Atlanta, police departments from Atlanta, Cobb County, and Dunwoody, the Fulton County Sheriff's Office, and law enforcement from the school districts of Carroll, DeKalb, Cobb, and Gwinnett counties all stepped in for the sweeps. Dunwoody Police Major Oliver Fladrich calls the FBI a great force multiplier.
We do a lot of the legwork, obviously. Our investigators do the actual field work. We do the takedowns, secure the scene, all that kind of stuff. But the real work happens in those interview rooms. This is really where you get down to the nitty-gritty and you can identify true victims.
The whiteboard in the briefing room tells agents, officers, deputies where they're fanning out. Day one, they're targeting a child sex offender who's absconded from Georgia to Tennessee. A hotel room is wired with mics and cameras. Agents sip from disposable coffee cups, peer at squares of surveillance screens, scour online ads for a New Orleans slim, thick caramel delight, memorize the features of a missing boy. After a sting, an agent sifts through a survivor's purse, pulling out a 9-shot revolver and a stack of $50 bills. In Metro Atlanta, 4 people were arrested, and 9 of the 28 children rescued had been trafficked for sex. FBI victim specialist Amanda Gully in Atlanta sits in a quiet room with a rescued teen, getting her to open up.
Obviously, we want to get the information and we want to get the evidence that we need for prosecution, but our teams are always so focused on making sure that the victim is safe, the victim is taken care of.
Special Agent Taylor Dervish admits sometimes those being rescued don't see see it that way.
That's the problem with sex trafficking. The victims are not somebody who has had something stolen from them in terms of money or their car. Most of our victims don't self-identify as victims.
She explains they've often been lured online, a compliment on a picture, a private message. She says traffickers often sell the idea of this life as a glamorous one. Sometimes the snare is a little slower.
Boyfriend figures, which we would call Romeo traffickers, attempt to get these girls to believe that they are in a relationship and then turn it away from the grooming and into more of a forced exploitation.
Dervish tells me it took years for her to finally feel she had a grasp on how to work these cases, and it's what she wants to keep doing.
It's recovering the kids, even when they're cussing at you and yelling at you, you know, it's gratifying to know that you've helped them in that moment, but I also think it's gratifying to get sentences on these traffickers 15, 20, 25 years, to know that at least for that amount of time, they're not going to harm another child.
In Atlanta, Veronica Waters, 95.5 WSB.
Thank you, Veronica. Coming up next, we'll update the Fulton District Attorney's efforts to get the governor to testify to the grand jury and the emerging Georgia campaign theme you could call Show Me the Money. Stay with us. Atlanta's Morning News Sunday edition continues. It's time for a Sunday roundtable. Joining us is WSB political analyst Bill Crane from CSI Crane. You can see his weekly blog and vlog, handy link on WSBRadio.com, and Atlanta Journal Constitution political reporter Greg Bluestein. Follow his Politically Georgia podcast at AJC.com and check out Greg's book, Flipped: How Georgia Turned Purple. Guys, it's good to be with you on Sunday.
Good to be
Happy
with you.
Sunday.
Well, let's look ahead, and certainly we'll get off to a quick start, Greg Bluestein, the beginning of the week, the next round of the Fulton County grand jury investigation of the 2020 election, and this court hearing that could determine whether Governor Kemp is compelled to testify.
You know, the national media was rightly focused on Rudy Giuliani and his testimony 6 hours behind closed doors, but to me, the bigger story might have been the fact that Governor Kemp, A, has not already testified because we thought, a lot of folks thought, that he had already taped a videotaped testimony that was played before the grand jurors, but B, that he's now trying to block his testimony, saying, hey, look, we're too close to the election. We're less than 3 months out, and it would take significant time to prepare him for all the questions he could get. So Fannie Willis, she's not taking it. She's saying that Brian Kemp's lawyer acted with dishonorably, without respect for her office, and is pushing forward to have him testify in that special grand jury proceedings. And we're not sure exactly what they're looking for from Brian Kemp, but we can expect one of the main topics will be Donald Trump's phone conversation with him in December of 2020, where he urged the governor to call a special session to reverse the outcome of the 2020 vote.
Of course, this will be in front of Judge McBurney. Greg, do we have any indication of what Giuliani actually said to the grand jury when he was here last week?
We do not. We have I have a pretty good assumption he didn't say much because his lawyer said that he would either be invoking attorney-client privilege about conversations he had with the former president or invoking the Fifth Amendment, because now we know the other big news was that he has been informed, his attorneys have been informed, that he could be the target of criminal prosecution for his role in this effort to overturn the election. So now he can plead the Fifth, saying he, you know, invoking his right not to self-incriminate himself.
About all I heard him say was, well, I didn't walk to get to Atlanta. Bill Crane.
I didn't walk, he flew.
Yeah. Bill Crane, the governor is accusing the DA of playing politics here. Now, what do you think about this process?
Well, as Greg said, we thought they'd already given a video deposition that apparently was postponed, and then there were attempts by the governor's office to get it rescheduled. If you pull this into September and October, you are getting dangerously close to the general election, and where it's problematic for Governor Kemp is he's had to walk a tightrope for most of the last year, running, you know, for the entire state, but particularly among Republicans, trying to keep Trump voters in the tent. And I imagine what they'd want to ask him in front of the grand jury is about conversations between the governor and the president and his advisors, which there were several. We got the, you know, audio tape of the conversation with Brad Raffensperger. We know about the conversation with Chris Carr, the attorney general, the head of the Secretary of State Elections Division. But we don't know how those conversations went with the governor or other elected officials. And I imagine, knowing Governor Kemp, particularly when perhaps some of those calls were coming from Mark Meadows or Rudy Giuliani or some of the president's advisors. There's a side to Brian Kemp most of us don't get to see very often, and I bet they got to see that. And that's not something you want to be doing in front of voters that you're asking to get up and vote and support you, both in early voting, absentee voting, and at the polls in a few weeks. So not unlike the request by Burt Jones, because Fannie Willis had a fundraiser for her opponent, his opponent. Mm-hmm. I think there's validity to politicizing the process and waiting this long to call the governor when so many other constitutional officers in Georgia were called months ago.
Well, let's talk about the campaign for governor. There are obviously issues that delineate the main candidates, Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp. And Greg, but to the casual observer, it almost looks like they're trying to outdo each other and how much money they can give back to the electorate.
That's a great way to put it, because there's a surplus of more than $5 billion. There's also billions of dollars still left unspent from the America Rescue Plan, the Coronavirus Relief Act. It was passed in early 2021. And state law gives the governor immense leeway, immense power over how to spend that money. He can set the budgets, lawmakers have to sign off on the budgets, but he can set revenue estimates. And when it comes to this federal relief money, he has almost total control about how to spend this money. Well, the governor's plans for 2023, he issued his first major plans just a few days ago, involve basically $1,000 for most Georgia families. That's $500 in homeowners relief and homeowners rebates, and about $500 per household, $1 billion overall of tax rebates for Georgia families. This came a few days after Stacey Abrams outlined her plans, which involved her own $1 billion plus tax rebate for Georgia families that would amount to about $500 per family. She also supports legalizing casino gambling and sports betting to raise more revenue for needs-based higher education scholarships.
Bill Crane, digging a little deeper into that, is this discretionary money at the governor's disposal, or does he have to get the legislature to go along with him?
Congress bracketed it, but once it gets to the state and it is in the hands of the executive agency and the governor's office, as Greg said, there's lots of flexibility on how you actually dole it out. For example, the governor announced last week $240 million in grants to bring high-speed internet to rural Georgia. And that may not sound like much to those of us in Atlanta who can go to Starbucks or sit in our living room and have Wi-Fi, but during the pandemic, a lot of these rural counties, the school kids could not get online classrooms because there wasn't reliable high-speed internet or Wi-Fi anywhere near them. And this will allow that. And there's been multiple instances of attempts all the way back to Tony Perdue's years as governor to expand high-speed broadband and Wi-Fi internet access statewide to give the Municipal Electric Authority of Georgia exclusive franchises in their markets to build out that infrastructure. But it's very expensive. So this money will allow about 140,000 more Georgians who don't have that access now to get it. That's tangible. And again, as a result of the pandemic, a lot of kids got even further back in school systems and their education in those rural counties. So there are tangible things that an incumbent governor can do. And whether you're a Republican or Democrat, you got a lot of federal money still sloshing around that will start getting clawed back in 2023 if it hadn't been spent.
Yeah. Well, let's take it into the race for the United States Senate between Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker. And maybe he was talking about Georgia. Maybe he wasn't when Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was speaking to a Chamber of Commerce group in Kentucky late last week, saying certainly he thought that the House of Representatives would go Republican, but he didn't think the Senate would because of what he was calling the quality of the candidates. Greg, what do you think he was talking about?
You know, this could be a motivating tactic for Senator McConnell to try to encourage more Republican donors to step up to the plate and give so we can have even more TV and radio ads. But I think here's what I know. The race in Georgia continues to be close. Senator Warnock is ahead by 3-4 points in some of the polls. Others show it even closer than that. Republicans have not, raised the white flag in this race at all. But there are other states like in Pennsylvania and Arizona where there are in Ohio even, where there are races that are tilting in the Democratic direction, and that is causing a lot of Republican concern right now. Georgia, though, we're still seeing ungodly amounts of money being spent overall. $260+ million has been spent on the airwaves in Georgia alone between the governor's race and the Senate race, and most of it on the Senate race, which is an obscene amount of money.
And still just under 80 days to go until the election. Bill Crane, some thoughts on the race for the United States Senate. What do you think McConnell was talking about, and do the Republicans have a reason to be worried here?
They do. There were several states where there were not Republican incumbents, where there were judged to be weak Democratic incumbents that the Republicans were looking to pick up. And early polling data that put Democratic incumbent against Republican challenger favored the GOP. But those were races in states, the two were just referenced by Greg, where Donald Trump inserted himself into the process, a popular governor in Arizona who challenged and did not support the president, the former president, on his election claims. Was among those that, just like Governor Kemp here, that Donald Trump wanted out of office. So he essentially was able to get a plurality win for his Senate candidate, an untested venture capitalist, who was in support of the election conspiracy theories, and who is now a pretty weak GOP nominee trailing in a state where there was a troubled Democratic incumbent who likely looks like he's going to take that seat. Val Demings has got a really close race, it looks like, with Marco Rubio down in Florida. That was unexpected. So when you've got a 50-50 split, any two or three races are critical. And where the GOP is right now, they're speaking with their checkbook and they're moving the Republican National Senatorial Committee monies into states they believe they can win or where they can push all Republican vote up 2 to 3 percentage points, which will be critical in states like Georgia, where Raphael Warnock is slightly leading, but turnout's going to decide the election.
Okay. Let's dig deeper here for just a minute in how media and politics intersect here, with the Florida federal judge saying he'll make public at least part of the affidavit detailing evidence that led to the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago. Greg Bluestein, what should the public expect from this, and will it just be a bunch of black lines through things that would otherwise illustrate the story?
It could very well be heavily redacted. I always support more transparency, and so I'm glad that media organizations all over the country are fighting to get this document unsealed. And it's sort of this rare confluence where we're also seeing Republicans and Democrats push to get this unsealed, especially some allies of former President Trump are pushing to get this unsealed because they want to show that, that this is all trumped up or whatever, for whatever the reason. This is such an important investigation that I hope that the public gets more, this sheds more light on what investigators are looking for.
Bill Crane, I'd like to get your thoughts on what the Atlanta City Council did after a long discussion this past week.
We're trying to relieve pressure from County.
One exchange between colleagues, the extra-long council discussion over the plan to lease up to 700 Atlanta jail beds to Fulton County.
The Fulton County Jail has been in bad stead and operating under a federal court supervision for years. Their northern annex up in the north part of Fulton County has been closed and being renovated. Their south Fulton annex is not operating at present, and there's about 800 detainees at the Fulton County Jail who spend a lot of time sleeping on the floor, which is just inhumane. So they are going to be leasing at $50 per inmate per night space from the City of Atlanta from its vacant detention center, formerly the City of Atlanta Jail. I think this is long overdue. There are social justice advocates that are already upset, and certainly this was a major demonstration of Andre Dickens' political will, because he said to the City Council, "This isn't our fault, but it is our problem." And to be able to crack down more on offenses in the City of Atlanta, and more just than just tough talk, you also have to have places to put people until they bail out. So I think this was long overdue. I credit Sheriff Pat Labatt for pushing this deal through. And I think the City Council by, 10, I can't remember if the vote was 10. It was a significant majority vote in favor of making this move. And this is the same City Council, with a couple of exceptions, that voted to close the jail under Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms a few years ago.
Guys, one more thing here. One of the feel-good moments of the past week with Governor Kemp and Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens together at the announcement that Atlanta would host the 2025 College Football Championship game. And while Governor Kemp isn't shy at all about predicting Georgia will be in that game, Mayor Dickens said, "Hey, what about my school?"
I'm with the governor. We can get Georgia back to back to back, and then in 2025, we can have the Bulldogs versus the Yellow Jackets, y'all, right here for the national championship. That would be amazing, given where my Yellow Jackets got to go to get there. But we, we're going to pump some life into them with this announcement today.
I love it. Any thoughts, Greg?
Scott, we know that Georgia Tech's only won 9 games in the last 3 seasons. And we also know that Mayor Dickens recently fractured his foot. So I just worry that he might be on too many pain medications right now. to have make that prediction that Georgia Tech will play Georgia in 2025, although it'd be quite a moment for Atlanta.
We have a Bulldog alumni going here, meeting going here, Bill Crane. Any thoughts on what the mayor had to say?
Well, yeah, and in fairness, I'm a fan of Andre Dickens, and I like watching the Atlanta United play in Bobby Dodd Stadium. But that, besides the fact that it's not going to happen, if it did, it'd be horrible for the city because you would have locals not needing hotel rooms, not needing downtown reservations, not basically doing what happens in a championship game. You'd have some, you know, national media flying in and some big ticket folks who want to see whatever the national championship game is. But those events are about drawing in travel and business dollars. And if it's two local teams, you don't make a lot of money.
Greg Bluestein, Bill Crane, always come away better after our conversations. Hey, thanks a lot. Have a great day and a great week.
Take care.
You too.
We'll be right back. And finally, in our Sunday edition of Atlanta's Morning News, the ivory-billed woodpecker was declared extinct in 2019, but now some people have claimed to have seen it, and it may be right here in Georgia.
The mystery of the ivory-billed woodpecker. Its last confirmed sighting was documented in 1944 in Louisiana. Is it extinct, or is it hiding out right here in our state?
This bird could certainly be hidden in Georgia swamps along any of the coastal plains rivers.
Adventure wildlife photographer Marsh Dean says finding it, though, is not easy.
We can't get into these alligator-laden, mosquito-filled swamps to look for this bird, or at least most people can't. That's what I do. I search these swamps. I go as deep as I can in my kayak.
I might make it look easy, scampering around through these waters barefoot. But remember, I've spent my life here.
There are people who have claimed to have seen them and have video, but the videos are very grainy, and the ivory bill looks a lot like the pileated woodpecker.
There's the raccoon swimming across right up there.
If you're out there in a swamp and a large woodpecker flies by, you know, you really have to get that perfect shot to know whether it's a pileated or whether it's an ivory bill.
So what are the chances that the so-called Lord God bird is in our state and you'll find it?
I think chances are pretty slim, but as long as there are chances, and the rarer it is, if I happen to find it, then that's a much bigger deal.
So for now, Dean continues his search.
I want to see that bird. I just saw it in flight, and it very well could be an ivory-billed woodpecker.
Sabrina Cupid, 95.5 WSB.
If you see it, get a picture. Thanks, Sabrina. And thank you for joining us for our Sunday edition of Atlanta's Morning News. I'm Scott Slade. We'll talk to you again tomorrow morning on 95.5 WSB.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.